What's up, guys? You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We record episodes and interview the very best experts from around the world and cover topics relating to health, success, mindset, business, and even social issues. And each week, we give you some of the best advice and information on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. Your elite life begins now. On today's episode, episode number 344, entitled, How to Harness the Inner Drive That Navy SEALs, Entrepreneurs, and Pro Athletes Use to Have Unbelievable Success, I chat with Dr. Doug Brockman. Dr. Doug Brockman is a psychologist and author of Driven, Understanding and Harnessing the Genetic Gifts Shared by Entrepreneurs, Navy SEALs, Pro Athletes, and Maybe You. In today's episode, Dr. Brockman talks about the unique drive that lies in a certain segment of the population, including many elite men. He breaks down the hidden powers that harnessing this drive can bring and the insidious pitfalls that may accompany this gift as well and lead to its possessor's downfall in life. If you're wondering how to unleash this powerful inner drive upon the world, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. And guys, if you haven't checked out our incredible Elite Life Vitamin C, go to EliteLifeNutrition.com right now and order it today. Our incredible vitamin C is buffered, so it's easy on the stomach. It's non-acidic. You can take a lot more of it without having an upset stomach and actually being able to absorb the vitamin C. And it's also loaded with grapeseed extract, rutin, rose hips, and acerola fruit extract as well. These four extra ingredients really add to the benefits that the vitamin C has and actually brings out the power in a synergistic way. They all work together to make the vitamin C more powerful and beneficial for you and your family during these hectic, crazy times. Go to EliteLifeNutrition.com and stock up on vitamin C right now. If you get two bottles, you get 5% off. If you get four bottles, you get 10% off. And if you get 12 bottles or more, you get 15% off. You can give one or give out a few to your friends, your family, everybody you love around you who wants to boost their immune system. They're going to absolutely love our incredible vitamin C. Go to EliteLifeNutrition.com right now. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine. And my guest today is Dr. Doug Brockman, the author of the book Driven. Doug, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you on, man. And as you mentioned before we jumped on the podcast, talked a little bit, but you're not your typical psychologist, which is kind of cool. It's good. It's refreshing to talk to someone a little bit different who has that type of background, but also thinks a little bit differently. It's always interesting to interview these types of people, and it seems like you're one of them. So I'm excited to bring you on and talk about a lot of the concepts in Driven and some of the things you're about and, you know, speak about now, especially how the world's changing so fast. It's good to have a voice like yours to sort of be a voice of reason in these times, in these chaotic times.
Yeah, it's it is a phenomenal, fantastic time to be alive. I can tell you that as a psychologist and a social psychologist, cultural anthropologist, these are times of changing.
Absolutely. How long have you been a psychologist for? Have you been around doing this work?
Oh, I've been doing this 35 years. I'm older than you. I look, but it's I got licensed in psychology. I'm a California licensed psychologist. Got licensed in 2003, I think. Somewhere in there. So it's been a good 20 years or close to it. Prior to that, I was doing a whole bunch of addiction research and addiction medicine. So I was been working in the field of addiction since I was 18 years old. So I've been it basically my whole life.
Nice. That's awesome, man.
It is what I do. Yeah.
What made you want to get into the field? Are you someone who's like me, who basically has a fascination with this type of stuff? Because I went through it. Did you ever go through any of these types of things psychologically, anxiety, depression, those types of things, or was it something else that drew you?
I am a high school dropout that lived in a car. So I completely blew my life up when I was 17.
Nice.
And it is, despite what any psychologist tell you, we all get into psychology to figure our own shit out. So and the good ones actually do. And I was incredibly fortunate to, right place, right time. And I just got, I got basically into recovery at 18 years old and have maintained most of it for 35 years now. So I've been in this field the whole time. obviously went back and wound up with getting a dual PhD, meaning I have two PhDs, which is a stupid amount of education. It's ridiculous. And it's in clinical psychology was my first and foremost. That's where my real passion. And because my father asked me one question, he said, won't it be tough to make a living as a clinical psychologist? I wound up getting a second PhD in organizational business psych. So
what is that exactly?
So industrial organizational psychology is really looking at the group dynamics within a company and how groups interact and really organizational structure and design. Organizational development was my underlying organizational development and culture.
Right. Who hires you? CEO? Is that the, like execs?
Yeah, exactly.
Bring you in.
My passion back then, what I was thinking when I got into grad school was I was going to go be an executive coach. And that's basically what I wound up doing. But it's turned into a very interesting journey with my own story kind of leading the way. So third or fourth grade, I had this profound awareness that what we were doing in school was bullshit, basically. And meaning that I was, kind of aware that memorizing multiplication tables was just a waste of time. Like, what are we doing here? And so ever since then, it's been this kind of felt like I was different, felt like I didn't really kind of go along with just the party line, kind of an internal cynic and.
Nice.
Yeah. And so that led to, 18, 19 years old, coming to consciousness in a locked psych ward. And, as a result of amphetamine psychosis, I figured out how to freebase cocaine at 18, and it blew my life up, completely blew my life up. But at the same time, I was very aware that I also wasn't crazy. I mean, I knew that there was something up with me, but I wasn't quite sure. And in the intervening 30 years, I pretty much come to the conclusion that I am exactly the way I'm supposed to be. And there's about 8 or 10% of the population, a little less than that, actually, that match a certain personality type and genetic underlying kind of structure that makes us the way we are. And that's the core of what I work on now. That's my book, Driven.
What is that 8 or 10%? Like, how would you describe yourself? And do you subscribe to the Myers-Briggs personality and all that stuff?
I'm a huge fan of Carl Jung. Yeah, I'm Jungian. That's all based on Jungian typology.
Yep.
Yeah, so I'm very much, and that there's a lot of bio research that actually supports that. So, yes, I do.
So what type are you? Would you say you are? And then that 8 to 10% that makes you so different than the rest of the population?
So I am an introverted, intuitive, feeling judger. Okay. Very strong INFJ. We're about 2% of the population, but what I'm talking about is on top of that.
Yeah.
And I've actually done some research with the people I work with that do personality types. And, if you're driven, that's simply what I'll call it. You do then have these other genetics or other personalities on top of that. You can be an introverted driven or an extroverted driven or an intuitive driven or a thinking driven or a feeling driven. And let me get into driven real quick. So basic theory is, and this is over the last 20 years, really, they did two things in the last 20 years. They figured out the functional MRI. Yeah. So we can actually look in real time what's going on in the brain. Second thing they did is crack the human genome.
Yep.
And the understanding of genetics has completely evolved. There used to be a huge question, is it nature versus nurture? Is it your genetics or is it your environment? That question has been completely washed away. And what it's been replaced with is the field of epigenetics, which means that our environment turns on and off our genetics. And so what I'm seeing and I'm actually getting some good research around it, that what I'm talking about, drivens, are actually increasing in our society. So what the theory is, and this I'll credit a couple different people for this rather than myself, and I read, it was Thomas Hartmann, I read his book in 2001, and he was the first to really look at the hunter-farmer theory, and meaning that, you know, there are different types of people in this world. And 4,000 years ago, something happened called the Agricultural Revolution. And the human genome, because of the epigenetics, really started to adapt to that environment. And you think about what a farming world is compared to a hunter-gatherer society, a farming world is boring. You are literally wired to sit around and watch shit grow. You are not seeking new novel adventures. You are not going outside of the norm. You are, most importantly, the brain structure starts to adapt where you put 90% of the people in functional MRIs. You see this nice, bright, shining ball of activity in the frontal lobe, right in the middle of your frontal lobe. And it's the executive function of the brain. And so the executive function is this linear, rational, logical way to go through the world. And you put your finger in the ground, you put a little corn in it, you tap it, you water it, you wait patiently, it grows, in. And as long as we did last year what we do this year and we do that next year, all of our worries will be okay. And so most of the human population adapted to this agricultural agrarian society. And on top of that, they came into these huge societies. You know, 10,000 years ago, we were running around in little groups of 40 and 60 people, 80 people at the most, maybe 100. But, you know, after that, once the agricultural revolution took off, we come into these giant societies. So Hartman said that his son, who was struggling with ADD and ADHD, he said, there's got to be a biological, good biological reason that these kids are like this, that there's a certain group of people that are like this. And that is the defining feature of ADD, is hypofrontality, meaning you don't have this nice ball of activity in your frontal lobe. And interesting, in my research, we have people that I work with, probably yourself, a ball of activity in the back of our heads. So we have occipital dominance, meaning that hunters compared to farmers use their eyesight to go through the world. And so we have radical visual acuity. One of the reasons a lot of the people I work with, we love to drive, we're good at sports, we do, you know, I work with a lot of professional golfers. We're using our eyesight combined with this underactive, and it's hypofrontal is a misnomer. And you look at the functional MRI and you look at the research around it, our brains are actually doing something called multi-thinking. And so rather than carrying three or four concepts in our head at the same time, like farmers do, we can carry 9 to 13.
Wow.
So we have big picture thinking combined with this, you know, ability to come up with new novel ways of doing things. It's really an entrepreneurial mind. And so, you know, a lot of people that hear this for the first time are like, whoa, wait a minute. Why? That explains why I'm sitting in fourth grade, not understanding why people, most of the class, was, you know, content with going through this rote, simple behaviors. Where I'm just like, what is the point of this shit? Don't you guys get the big picture that we're never going to use this again the rest of our lives?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole class looks at me and like, what the hell are you talking about? Just get the A and shut up and sit down. You know, and I'm 53 years old. So this was way before the ADD, ADHD craze. And so I'm classic ADD, ADHD. The other thing that's happened over, it appears to have happened, I don't have a time machine, so you can't know for sure, but our reward systems have dramatically changed compared from hunters to farmers. And, you know, farmers are very tolerant of boredom. And so dopamine receptor number 2, the DRD2, has variance in it. And so this M1, this A1, DRD2, A-A1 allele gene, it changes the way dopamine is carried within the cells and between the cells. And more importantly, when you or me, if we have this genetic allele, we never quite feel like things are good enough, ever. And so that capacity to actually, you know, look at Edison, and that was Thomas Hartmann's follow-up book, he called it the Edison gene, because it's 9,999 different ways to not make a light bulb, but he's never going to give up because he's constantly seeking that dopamine. A little bit more interesting genetics and is the dopamine receptor number 4. It's the other thing I look at. It's called the wandering gene, and it's a much older gene. You can trace it back 50,000 years. And it is the FOMO gene, the fear of missing out gene. So if you think about hunters, different from farmers, farmers are wired to feel like right here where we're at, watching these things grow is good enough. Hunters, on the other hand, are wired to feel like the grass is always greener over the next hill. We're wired to feel like there's more woolly mammoths over there. And if we didn't have that propensity to wander, we would kill everything in the valley we're living in and starve to death. So it was very servant. But it explained, you know, this combination of, you know, both genetics and brain structure explained my entire life, why I'm constantly seeking, why I'm constantly looking for that cutting edge, for the biohack, for the, you know, when I've done Ironman triathlons and I've got 2 PhDs and all of these things, trying to feel like I am enough. And that's really the core of what I do with all my, you know, executives is, you know, really look at, you know, I could have called the book, you know, a shame-based personality type. I wouldn't have sold shit. I wouldn't have sold any of them. But it's, it really is this, you know, theory. And this is the second book I have coming out, really about the identity differences between us. And if you think about, you know, farmers, as they came into these huge societies, their identities became really simple and they have a brain structure to support it. They're butchers, they're bakers, they're candlestick makers, and they're wired for W-2 jobs. And, you know, my joke is I'm basically unemployable. Between my cynicism and my, you know, questioning of authority and my reward deficiency and my ability to figure things out faster than most, I'm incredibly difficult to manage.
Yeah. You sound just like me.
Yeah. Well, more importantly is that I don't have this simple identity. I'm a Da Vinci. You know, was he a sculptor? Was he a painter? Was he a military historian? Was he a partier? He was all of those things and none of those things.
Yeah.
And so our identities are a mess. And the core of the book is really exploring that and what to do about that. Because if we don't have this nice logical butcher, baker, candlestick maker kind of identity, you know, checkbox kind of identity, we tend to use our emotions as a basis for our identity.
Yeah.
And because of my D2 wiring, I'm wired to feel like there's something missing or wrong all the time. And if I fold that into my identity, that is this feeling like there might be something missing or wrong with me.
Yeah.
And that is the core of what I do with myself and all of my work and why meditation, and I'm a big meditation proponent, you know, advocate, came up with some unique tools to teach people how to meditate that normally wouldn't. So it's really about killing of that self, of getting that shame-based, self-sabotaging identity in the forefront of our brains, and so we can really look at ourselves in a different way.
Yeah, this is incredibly fascinating. You said though that this type of personality and you know who people are is only about 8 to 10%. So when you wrote the book, are you writing to just a small percentage of the population, or can this be applied to numerous types of people and different personalities?
Well, the meditation practices, and this is what I've found, that most meditations and most treatments are designed for farmers by farmers. And, you know, why ADD, calling it attention deficit a disorder, anything you disorder something, you know, because we are different. We don't fit in. You know, we are the Navy SEALs. We are the elite. We are, you know, if we're not completely screwed off in our addictions, we wind up owning most of the crap in the world because we're never satisfied.
Yeah.
And we scare the crap out of farmers, you know, and I am a licensed psychologist, and most of this, my psychologist, you know, most of that DSM, the big book of crazy, you know, list of crazies, all it is just a whole bunch of labels of things that aren't normal.
Yeah.
By any stretch of the imagination, I'm sure most of your listeners and yourself, I don't consider myself normal. I mean, you want to go see normal, go stand in Walmart and take a look around, go to Disneyland and look at what's in line. That's average. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, most of those people aren't listening to podcasts or diving deep into their health or biohacking. I mean, it's just, so
yeah,
not saying they're not relevant to me, but they're, it's just a, you know, it's hard to not feel superior, but we need farmers as much as they need us. And so I think there is a collaborative need there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you get past, and by the way, they're not listening, you know, they're probably not listening to podcasts, and they're certainly not listening to an Elite Man podcast if they're average. But how do you get past the, and I want to dive into a bunch of concepts in the book too, you know, coming up, but the first thing that comes to mind is, how do you get past that need to always want more and not be satisfied, even when, you know, I'm sure you've accomplished so many great things in your life. And, you know, up until this point, you've done this, you've gotten 2 PhDs, you've, you know, had an incredible book, all these things, but how do you get past that lack of feeling of accomplishment? Like you've done something, like you finally made it. And like, you always kind of need more. Cause you know, people like you mentioned it, people like me, other people out there as well, we always have that drive to keep wanting more and more and more. But it's like, are we ever going to be fully happy and satisfied with achieving anything?
And so that's what I always joke about. Crossing the Ironman finish line is absolutely amazing for about two and a half seconds.
Yeah.
Then you turn around and you look at the time. Yeah. And immediately my biology, my wiring, my reward deficiency starts to go through the entire day about how I can make it better. Mm-hmm. What an amazing gift. And so, and a curse. It is a gift in that I can do better. The curse is that if I believe feelings are real, I'm screwed. Good enough is not a feeling. And that's this key part of, you know, how I teach meditation is really different than most. Meditation is about reality checking. And, you know, I say it all the time, feelings are not real. They're neuropeptide reactions we're having in our body. They're the most important things in the world because they literally change our perception of reality. So if I'm feeling like things aren't good enough, if I feel scared, all I see will be stick or snakes. And so it literally changes my perception. And so in that, you know, long answer to a great question is you have to be able to address your emotions in a different way. And I had to learn that, because if I'm using my feelings that, you know, no matter what I do, and that's my Jim Spira, my doctoral dissertation chair, first time, you know, I ever was called Dr. Brockman. Congratulations, Dr. Brockman. Clear as a bell, my monkey mind jumped in and said, ha ha, he bought it. Because my multi-thinking brain, I can think about every little corner I kind of didn't fully complete to perfection, and all of these little shortcuts and things I almost kind of plagiarized as examples of why that feeling might be real or why that feeling might be valid. And there's no such thing as a valid feeling, period. There isn't. Happy, sad, mad, glad. They're experiences. They're not truths. And so the joke is that the dissertation led to my PhD, and it's hanging on my wall. It was good enough. Checkbox. I mean, I made it. No matter how I feel about that, it doesn't matter. And so I work a lot in the executive world now, and we're founders. You know, founders-driven love to start companies and come up with great ideas. And what I primarily do with these guys is teach them that you cannot scale a hunting organization. And founders, you know, drivens, we are hunting the next big deal. We'll get this big deal. And then we'll figure out how to actually deliver. It's, you know, and they do it again and again and again. But you can't scale that. All you can scale is a farm. And so you really do have to trust and let the farmers build the farm, and then you can scale it. And so as a founder, though, if it feels like it's never good enough, that's a classic Steve Jobs story. He walks into the lab at Apple, drops his cell phone in the water, and there's bubbles coming up. And he says, there's still space in there. Make it better. Because it is the way we're wired. It's the way we see the world. But it's not reality.
Can you explain that a little bit more, that hunters can't scale? Do you mean like if a founder, an entrepreneur founds a business, he can't scale that business? Or are you talking more generally or philosophically?
Well, both. It is, so hunting organizations, you know, we're going to go out and try to figure out how to kill a woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
And I've got a great idea and we got a new spear to go do it. And that might be a great business model. And, you know, as long as you are, there's plenty of woolly mammoths. But it is way better to start a rabbit farm or a cattle ranch, to where you're actually putting up fences and boundaries and building processes and systems, which is a farm. Mm-hmm. Where my brain doesn't work that way. If I'm using my emotions, that I can always make it better, I'm tearing what I built down and trying to improve it. You know, the motto for drivens is, you know, if you can improve it, do. The mottos for farmers is, if it's good enough, don't fix it. Leave it alone. But we typically, just like Steve Jobs, we get fired from boards because of this. The boards, you know, once this company gets big enough and the board looks at us and says, leave it alone, we can't. And so it is a difficult day for lots of drivens when they face the opposition of the farm.
So would you say then that Jobs wasn't actually a great CEO? Maybe he was a good founder. Maybe he was a good person to start the company, but he's not actually good at running it?
I would say yes. He was.
Really?
I don't know if you've... I've actually been fortunate enough to work with some people that actually worked with him, and he was a number one asshole. He was a real prick.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But it's his drivens. We don't mean to be condescending. We don't mean to be, you know, the rest of the world to us can be perceived as stupid, slow, and lazy very easily. And it's a mistake. And it is, you know, his need for constant states of improvement. Farmers feel like they're never good enough then for him. And that's a terrible business model.
Yeah. Aren't farmers the ones who always want to think that everything's fine and yep. just kind of like, you know, go with the flow because they're content with being patient and seeing the seeds sprout and grow and
yep.
They don't want that. But then you have someone who's at the top doing that to them. It can kind of mess everything up.
Blows it up in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Who would you say then is actually like a good CEO that's famous? Like one of these billionaires or so. Can you give any examples?
CEOs. The mind of the CEO comes. I've read a bunch about this. It depends, obviously. You know, I don't work in the corporate world. I typically work in the startup world. And a good startup CEO is very different than the interim CEO, is very different than the corporate CEO. And so that different skill set and, you know, mm-hmm. really the as a driven, if you are driven and you're working in a company and it gets to that, there's something magic about that 10 million number. Once you kind of hit this wall. And drivens, you know, our biggest shortfall is believing that we need to understand the whole thing, the big picture, as long as we got the, as long as we can understand the whole company all at once, you know, we feel like we're in control and we can manage it. Once it starts to get bigger than that and we can't, we start to limit the ability to scale. Or we jump in and sabotage. And that's a huge problem I work with these guys. And it comes back down to that ability to step aside from your emotion, which is impossible to completely become unbiased. But that ability to step aside from your biases and see where your biases are, particularly when it comes to driven. So if you're in a loop of not feeling like your company is good enough, that's all you'll see. And yeah. So finding that bridging person, I call him a shepherd, but finding that person that's in between, that is actually able to speak farmer and speak driven, yeah, is gold. If you can find that, you know, Wickman calls that the, you know, the implementer, or the, you know, the guy who can actually bridge that gap.
Yeah.
And that is a skill set that, you know, if you can find that person, if you really are driven, if you, you know, this is what I'm talking about is ringing true for you, they're gold, and don't blow them up.
So drivens, they don't necessarily make good, or they don't particularly make good CEOs, but they can be good for coming up with the new ideas and putting somebody in place so that they have someone to basically have their vision, but then bridge them between what they're seeing and then what the rest of the farmers should be seeing as well.
Exactly.
A middleman.
It is that middleman or the shepherd, you know, somebody who actually can kind of, I don't mean it to be that way derogatory, but, you know, really manage the sheep, mm-hmm, you know, and keep the founder out of it because we walk in the room and everybody gets scared that we're going to make them feel bad.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, actually. It does. It's a good way to put it. What are some of the other major concepts you're talking about in driven, and, you know, what are some of the themes that stick out?
You mentioned risk. Risk is a very interesting dynamic when it comes to drivens. Most drivens will say that they are not risk takers because everything I do has a very calculated risk to it. But from the outside looking in, we're crazy. We will, you know, start a new company. We will do this, start a new product line, or just do it and try to figure it out along the way, where it doesn't feel risky to us necessarily. That is the cornerstone of this real risk tolerance. And things that normally feel risky to most people don't feel as risky to us. And so it's hard if you have this, you know, high risk tolerance, which I do, it doesn't feel like a risk to me, but that means you're a risk taker. And so I'm not a risk taker, then you probably are. You know, if you're really scared of risk, then you're not. And so, you know, I've worked with so many Navy SEALs and all these guys that, you know, it's not risky because we practiced and rehearsed so much. And it's like, dude, you're jumping out of an airplane. Are you kidding? Nah, it's not risky. There's a parachute. And you're like, yeah, well, from the outside looking in, you know, at our lives, we're pretty nutty.
Yeah. Are there any other everyday risks that people take that maybe driven people will do every day, but they won't even realize it, you know, it's risky. And then someone from the outside comes in and sees something that they're doing. They're like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? You're nuts. Are there any like more common ones aside from like jumping out of a plane?
Well,
like fast driving maybe comes to mind, or
fast driving,
starting a new business,
any of these things that seem like, you know, and it's dopamine, gambling.
Yeah.
You know, my day traders, all of that is just, you know, we have things that normal people that feel, you know, that they would never do that. They couldn't handle it, you know, and basically we're designed to live in a chaotic world.
Yeah.
If you think about the pre-agricultural world, it was saber-tooth tigers and cave bears and people wanting to hit you with a tomahawk in the head. And that's our world. That's what we're made for.
Yeah.
And so, you know, typically this other thing I talk about in the book a little bit called neuropeptide Y is designed for when we're under high stress circumstance, we perform better. And it's, I like chaos. When everybody's chaotic, you'll see the drivens in the group feel like they're at home and start to feel more together, like with it. This is the life that I'm designed to live in. And, you know, oftentimes, and I've worked a lot with people trying to retire, especially the guys coming out of the SEAL teams, man, it's a mess. All of a sudden life gets boring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do you do? And I've got another guy who I just wrapped up with, 80 years old and tried to retire. We can't retire. You know, it's just, we need this activity, constant state of moving. It's what we're made for.
Yeah. What's that guy going to do? He's 80 years old.
Yeah. He, what we did with him was developed a mentorship program where he was actually the guy he was one of the guys who worked with Steve Jobs in developing the computer early on in 68, 70, 72. I mean, really interesting guy, but he found purpose in mentoring new entrepreneurs, younger drivens, taking them under their wing and teaching them how to transition entrepreneurship into company building. Entrepreneurship to company building transition is huge. And he's a genius at it. He's got 5 or 6, 8 guys under his wing, and he does it for free, obviously, but he's just handpicks these guys and has found deep meaning in his life.
No kidding. And he was also a SEAL too?
No, he was.
Oh, that was someone else.
Yeah. It's a bunch of other guys.
Nice. That's awesome. So another thing that just came to mind too, is you mentioned earlier that you're very chaos and, you know, you're very unemployable. Like you have so many different things going on, and you know, there's a lot of you know, positive traits, but also a lot of negative ones that wouldn't make you a good farmer or, you know, a good employee. What do you do now though, to keep yourself in check? Like make sure you're getting everything done. Make sure your life is not too chaotic. Make sure, you know, you're getting your, getting the books balanced and, you know, doing the right things that a business would have to do. But as like an entrepreneur, as a solo entrepreneur, what are some of the things that you have to do to keep yourself in check?
So what's missing in our brain is the executive function, is this part of the brain that tells us what is next and what's most important. And, you know, most farmers see the world as this, like a conveyor belt coming at you. Hunters, on the other hand, see the world as a limitless opportunities. And so we see too much is basically what it is. And so when I encourage in the book, and I've got another book coming out about, you know, and actually a journal practice, we have to create that structure externally. And you're looking in my office, I got whiteboards all over the walls, and I'm writing, you know, all kinds of journal stuff. And what I do in the book is go into basically, and I say it very directly in the book, balanced is bullshit. You will never be balanced. Balancing is a constant state of course correction and movement. And I keep it simple in the book. You know, it's basic categories in life for finance, romance, and health. You know, you can do friends, family, fitness, finance, fun, and faith. You know, EO, entrepreneur organization, breaks it into 11 categories. You can break it into 50 categories. But it is reality checking. You know, it doesn't feel like I'm a good father. It doesn't feel like I'm a good husband. Am I? Meaning that I can look at the patterns and the, you know, the processes I'm putting in place in my life, that I have date night with my wife once a week. I check in with my kids. I pick them up from school 3 times. So no matter how I'm feeling, I can feel like I'm a father of the year, or I'm feeling like a piece of crap, I know I'm doing okay. Same thing with friends, fitness, health. You know, I've gone down crazy biohacking health paths and, you know, ultra marathons and Ironmans and everything else I've done, where very quickly you will get out of balance. And drivens, you know, we have this thing called hyper-focus, part of neuropeptide Y and part of our brain structure. that when I get into one of the categories of my life, I really get into it. Like, I'm going to be the fittest man in the world. And ignoring, you know, romance, ignoring finance. And my doctoral work, my doctoral dissertation was actually about self-sabotage. And that is this core bit of, you know, drivens that we have to create in the external world, is the ability to look at our whole life perspective. And, you know, drivens are famous for having one, maybe two categories somewhat optimized, and then the last one's a shit show. So if you're making a ton of money, that's awesome, but you're divorced three times. You know, or, you know, you're elite health, but you're making a ton of money, or your romance is, you know, out the window. So it's really getting out of that impulsive, chaotic need and creating a structure in the external. And you talked earlier, you asked this question about, you know, satisfaction. And what I teach is the difference between contentment and dissatisfaction. And contentment, tent meaning home or house in Latin, con is with and ment is full. So you're fully at home in your life in the present moment. Contentment is a present moment thing. Dissatisfaction is a future thing. And so being able to discern those differences, once somebody who's driven can really understand this concept, I absolutely love my life as it is right now. But my drivenness, I can scan my world and see, same statement, all the areas that are screwed up and messed up and I don't like. Another way to say that, same statement, how do I improve or make these areas of my life better? So I'm content with my present moment and dissatisfied with how good my life can become. And that is a key, and it is an identity change for driven. So we have to be able to anchor ourselves in this present moment. And, you know, our feelings are not facts. Our thoughts are not facts. You know, my opinion of myself, my opinion of anything is just my opinion. What is reality? Because I'm a big picture thinker and have this capacity for cynicism. I don't know, you know, and so being humble and really being grateful and then never being satisfied with how can I improve my life? Most importantly, because I'm driven, more is not better all the time. More fitness is not better. It is just more fitness. And so what is better? You know, functional fitness, and I'm able to sleep good and which allows me to be a better dad, allows me to be a better husband, allows me to make more money. And, you know, while I'm not making enough money, or am I more is better money? Well, is it in the sense that it's going to improve my fitness? Is it going to improve my relationship with my wife? Maybe, maybe not. And so it's that ability to really stand in reality and get an honest appraisal of your life. And that's where, you know, meditation, and most meditations are taught by farmers for farmers. And the style of meditation I teach is coming out of a very strong Zen background. And I backed into this, you know, it's 8-10 years ago now. I was working with a Navy SEAL guy, Navy SEAL sniper. And both, he was my Bujangan, he was an Aikido instructor of mine, martial arts instructor of mine. And I started talking about long range shooting. You know, I'm a long range shooting competitor. I've been shooting long range for, you know, 600 yard and 1,000 yard for 30 years. Sure. And I started bullshitting about it. And I was like, there's a lot of meditation going on there. He's like, yeah, let's. And so what we did was actually combined a very specific style of meditation with long range shooting. And backed into this thing that it cracks into a neuropeptide Y, into a presenting experience that's, you know, it's more powerful than a lot of the plant-based medicine work that guys are doing now. It's incredible. Really?
How does that look? What is it called? Is that the shooting meditation you mentioned before?
Shooting. So that's my tagline, is I teach people to meditate at gunpoint. but very simply, it demonstrates, and more importantly, helps you feel in your body sabotage. And the gun, very incredible teaching tool. Very simply, there is no recoil in the present. And I've got some big guns. I mean, I've got some crazy 50 cal crap that your body will anticipate the recoil. You will be scared of something that is going to come at you. But being able to hyper-focus using a lot of breathing techniques that I teach to really hold yourself in a present moment state where you're not anticipating recoil. And the normal division of our consciousness, where we have a kind of a neocortex consciousness, but then we have this observing ego, just consciousness, where you're not thinking, you're just watching yourself. The division between those fall away. It's a very, very Zen powerful experience when you can really feel the path of the bullet before the bullet is released. And you are in this intuitive open space of really optimal performance. It is Csikszentmihalyi, best way to describe it is flow. It's a flow state. And if you're driven and wired the way we are, we're wired for flow. We are made for that state of being. And, you know, I've demonstrated to, you know, thousands of people now that and all the drivens I've worked with that normally hate meditation. I sit there and, you know, try to meditate. Our multi-thinking brains go nuts. All of a sudden, it's just bouncing ping pong balls of, you know, 35 apps in our head running at the same time. But if you actually learn that meditation is actually concentration and focus, it's not relaxed. It is a state of presence. It's a state of optimal performance. And all these SEALs and all these, you know, high-end billion-dollar company CEOs that hate meditation for the first time in their life go, oh, that's meditation? Yeah, that's meditation. Where you can get into that flow state where things seem, it is, you can't miss the target because you know, you're manifesting. It feels like you've already made it. You've already hit it.
That's awesome. How do you get these people into that state?
So very simply, it is a combination of insight. And so I teach, you know, basic biology about how human beings work. And the basic biology is that, you know, we have a, and I use a metaphor for it, that human beings are very much, this is a Buddhist observation, that human beings are very much like an Indian elephant with a whole bunch of monkeys up on top trying to control it. And so neurobiologically, we have a body that is a thinking machine, you know, thinking fast and thinking slow. And it is a reflex machine. It's basically a mind of its own. And then we have a neocortex up on top that is primarily in difference from the machine below in that the neocortex is a time machine. So the monkey mind sits on top of this elephant, and the elephant seems to have a mind of its own. And my doctoral work, very simply to explain this, is, you know, this is why January sucks at the gym. It's because everybody's monkey mind has convinced the elephant that this time is different, that this time will be, you know, the time that I finally get the six pack. What happens by February is that the elephant begins to resist those changes. And that resistance, the couch starts to get stickier, is independent of actually the narrative that you create out of it. You feel that resistance to going to the gym. You may hear a monkey up in your head or a gorilla up in your head beating the shit out of the elephant. You're going to the gym. Then you'll hear another, you know, another lazy monkey up there going, nah, go tomorrow, go later. You have da-da-da-da. You may be feeling sick. Go to the bathroom first. I'm going to retile the roof instead. You come up with all these excuses to not follow through or go through with the change. And the other difference between the monkey mind and the elephant is wired to want the familiar, where the monkey mind is wired for infinite possibilities. And so there's natural kind of evolution that happens that we can create a world with our monkey minds that the elephant doesn't know how to handle. And so that's why we return to baseline. We subtly sabotage. And so I can optimize my health and optimize my finance, but I'm still going to be at the base rate suck because my romance is terrible. I optimize romance and figure that all out, but then all of a sudden my credit card bills are all stacked up and what the hell just happened? So we're in this constant state of monkey and elephant battle. So yeah. I ask you the question then, Justin, which one are you? Are you the monkeys or are you the elephant?
It sounds like I'm the monkeys because I'm the driven type.
So it's a trick question. The answer is obviously both.
Both, yeah. But you
can go more towards. And capital A-N-D, neither.
Okay.
And it's that neither window that I teach in this meditation, that neither window, because you can hear the monkey mind chattering. You can hear the 18 different thoughts. You can hear the different ideas. More importantly, you can feel the impulsive elephant. You can feel the resistance to going to the gym. You can feel the resistance of pulling the trigger. And the elephant, that's an elephant thing because it's avoiding a potential future threat. But with the monkey mind hyper-focusing on things happening in the present and attending to things happening in the present, that resistance will fade away and fall away. Only if you're observing, and that when that observer melts and falls into the division between that's normally there between the monkey mind and the elephant, you're in that flow state. And that's the good news, bad news of that. Good news is, or the bad news, good news is that in the present moment, you can accomplish anything. There's no reason you can't do it. The bad news is there's no reason you can't do it except for yourself. The only problem you have is yourself. And if you're driven, and that's where I really anchor my work, if you're driven, you have to learn to manage this elephant. You have to learn to manage this impulsive behavior or you wind up living in a car or blowing your relationship up or blowing your business up or blowing your family up or blowing your health up.
And so, blowing yourself up.
Exactly.
Wow. That's such a good point, man. And it's true. I know a lot of people too that, you know, they were very bright individuals, very driven. You know, they had everything, all the opportunity, you know, basically the world in their palm, so to speak. And then they end up, you know, living in a car or broke or down and out or on drugs. I mean, I'm sure I was going to mention this earlier too, but I kind of forgot, but I'm sure that driven people have a higher propensity to be addicts. Does that seem to be true? Or
where my research started and Time Magazine came out with an article in 1991. So it was 4 years after I graduated high school or didn't graduate high school and was back in college, and the human genome started to unfold and they came out, you know, the alcoholism gene, that was the DRD2-A1 allele gene. Within 3 years in research, it's related to eating disorders. It's relating to gambling addiction. It's related to high success. It's related to, you know, all kinds of things. The addictive personality.
Yeah.
And, you know, the D2 and then the brain structures and the functional MRI took that research and ended, you know, extended it to a whole bunch of, and really trying to get rid of the pathology. You know, we're not broken. There's nothing wrong with us. We're supposed to be this way. And, you know, you look at the alcoholism rates, particularly in Native American cultures and, you know, which is largely driven people, they're hunters. And you know, yeah. some reservations have 70-80% alcoholism rates. I mean, it's horrible. Oh, not designed to live on a reservation. Oh. You know, so we're just trying to numb ourselves out from this world that the farmers took over from us.
Yeah, that's incredible. What else do you want to mention as far as you know, one of the themes from the book or did we cover like most of the things that you want to mention? And we are coming up on some time here, but is there any other like last thing you wanted to mention as far as like a takeaway from the book?
I'll say it again. You're not broken. I mean, a lot of the guys in, you know, the imposter syndrome, which, you know, kind of comes and goes from pop psychology, is our core wiring. My inner experience, because I'm driven, feels like I'm not enough, feels like I'm not good enough. But on the outside, people looking in at me, it's like, dude, you got no reason to feel this way. And so, you know, getting out of that should trap, I should feel different than I feel, is even the thought of that, try to figure that one out. I think I should feel different than I do. That's crazy. Compared to worms, compared to what? What are you talking about? How do you feel? And learning how to meet your feelings differently, if you're driven, it's kind of imperative. I mean, you have to. So otherwise, you know, no matter what we do, it's never good enough.
What is the quickest way or the easiest way when you work with your clients to get them to overcome an overbearing emotion, something that's just taken over, you know, whether it's a rejection, a heartbreak, a job loss, any other type of loss, like when an emotion is really just crippling them, what's the best way that they can combat that and get them, you know, their sanity back in that moment?
So it's the logical understanding. I call it my book, The Logical Container, because it contains the impulsive elephant. And so panic attacks, great example, you know, where the monkey mind is battling the elephant's sensations, and, you know, chick dumps you and it feels horrible. Feelings are not problems to solve. That's a neuropeptide reaction happening in your body. Yes, it sucks. Yes, it doesn't feel good. But so what? Who cares? Yeah, but it's you're scared that the elephant is going to start to make decisions for you. You know, should I call a chick? Should I not? And you get stuck in that spin. And I say it all the time. There is no emotion in the present. There's only sensations. And feeling those sensations, literally of the fascia of your heart breaking. I mean, got divorced when I was 31, man. It crushed my soul. And it's a horrible sensation. But I'm not in danger. There's really nothing wrong right now. Yes, the sensations are bad. And as long as I can meet the elephant with that curiosity, knowing that it's not going to destroy me. And the moment I can meet it with curiosity, it starts to change almost instantly. It's not as bad. Huh. But the monkey and elephant battling is what most people call, you know, that's suffering. That's dukkha. That is, you know, where I don't want to feel this way anymore. Then you start to feel a second set, or, you know, you have a primary emotional trigger where, you know, a chick dumps you. The secondary one is, I wish it was different. Because then you have regret, and then you have fear, and then you have, you know, and then the monkeys start taking over, and no one's going to ever love me again. You know, it turns into a hell realm where the whole thing is ridiculous. And, it, you know, that change of identity, and I do it directly in my book, core concept in my book, is, you know, the quickest path to hell is trying to figure out who you are. There's no answer to that. The way I do it in the book is what you are. What you are is a homo sapien. What you are is an animal, period. Number two is, you know, if you're driven, and that's all my, you know, I'm centered all around, I am driven, being okay with it. Because I'm driven, I'm going to feel chronic discontent. Because I'm driven, I'm going to feel FOMO about everything. Because I'm driven, I'm going to be impulsive. And I'm going to do things that most people think are nuts. And I don't think so, because I figured them out. And if I don't learn to manage that, it can destroy me. If I learn to manage it, it's the greatest gift in the world. And it's awesome.
Yeah.
But that's awesome. You know, so managing emotion is not managing it. It's meeting it with curiosity and logic that there's really nothing wrong. It's just your body's having sensations. And that's it.
Love it, man. There's so many great takeaways in this episode. I really do appreciate you coming on. You've already given a bunch of messages, but is there a last send-off message you'd like to leave, and also a place our listeners can check out your work and also the book?
Yeah. So books, everything Dr. Doug is on imdriven.com. And there's a free assessment there, and it gives 10, 12 page feedback tool. And I'm really interested, you know, if anybody can send that assessment around, because I am doing some real, you know, controlled research. I actually had it nationally normed, and I'm looking at some real data. So I'm getting as many of those things done as I can. And then I free download, I think, the first 3 chapters or 5 chapters of my book and audiobook too on my website.
Nice. All right. I'm going to link it up in the show notes. Doug, thanks again for coming on, man. I really do appreciate it. I know our guys are going to love this episode and also the book as well. Fascinating. I'm going to check it out myself and zip through it, because I know I'm a driven type of person as well. So thank you again, man, for coming on. Take care, and I'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.